Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me is a man that's fresh off the boat from the island of the misfit toys. He is the captain.
Thank you. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you.
Merry Christmas, Captain.
You smell like beef and cheese. You don't smell like Santa.
I might smell like beer and cheese. This week, we are drinking Mississippi Mud, Black and Tan by Matt Brewing Company. You've probably seen this one before, even though you don't know that you've seen it. This is the one that comes in the big jug-looking thing that has the big alligator on it. Garage grade 3.5 out of 5 bottle caps. Mississippi Mud is brought to us by some of our favorite True Crime Garage Army members. First, we have Dave. Dave wants to wish his good friend Hutch from Toronto, Canada, a very happy birthday. So happy birthday, Hutch, from your buddy David, and of course, from myself and the captain.
Like your jib.
Next, we have Becky from the ever-so-popular location of Parts Unknown. Also, we have Deborah, who says she can't get enough True Crime Garage. I think Deborah must live down the street from Becky in beautiful Parts Unknown. We want to say hi to Sean and to Tim. Tim, who says, keep up the good work, guys. And we also have Daphne in Los Angeles, who says next time we are in LA, she would like to treat us to a proper round.
Treat yourself, folk.
That's right. Next up, we have Ryan, who says, I like your Ghibli giblets. Pour one on the garage floor for me. Well, go ahead, Captain. Just dump a beer on the floor for Ryan.
Nick has to clean up after every show, so that would be not nice to Nick.
And last but not least, we have Monica in Washington, who recommends Belching Beaver Horchata Imperial Milk Stout.
Say what?
So we'll add that one to the list. So thank you for everybody for kicking in for the beer fun this week. And if you'd like to buy us around for next week's show, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And like always, you can follow us on Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, and Untappd, all at True Crime Garage.
That's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer, and let's talk some true crime. This is True Crime Garage. And this is the case of Jessica Chambers.
Several people are being questioned, but so far, no arrests yet in the brutal murder of a Panola County, Mississippi teenager.
Well, even seasoned investigators are calling Jessica Chambers' murder the most brutal crime they've ever seen. The 19-year-old was found Saturday near Cortland, Mississippi. She was set on fire inside her car and died later. WREG's April Thompson tells us how her family says they're barely holding on.
I've been doing it 21 years now, and as far as the manner of death, this is certainly one of the worst I've ever dealt with.
District Attorney John Champion said Tuesday investigators are leaving no stone unturned for the killer of 19-year-old Jessica Chambers.
We're bringing, you know, folks in to interview and talking to different, potential witnesses. But as far as arrests are concerned, there have been none made.
Champion wouldn't talk about Chambers' autopsy results or her activities the night she died. He did say investigators are checking her cell phone to see who she'd been talking to.
Something went wrong and we don't know what yet.
Charlotte Wilkerson says she was brought in for questioning after her phone number showed up.
And they took her phone records, and I was in there as she called me Auntie Shasha. And I was in there, Shasha, and I went and, talked to them just Sunday evening.
She was a loving child, man, 19 years old, just finished high school, had her whole life in front of her.
Ben Chambers, Jessica's father, says he's in pain, knowing how terribly she must have suffered.
98% of her body was burnt. The only thing that wasn't burnt was the bottom of her feet. It's just destroyed our family, man. Destroyed our family.
He says he has faith that investigators will find who's responsible for his daughter's death, and is touched by the show of support from people who heard about the tragedy.
From New York to East Coast to West Coast, people I've never even heard a dream call me, and like Saturday night, they all going, light a candle for my daughter.
December 6th, 2014. This case takes place in Courtland, Mississippi, which is in the northern part of the state. We have a young woman, Jessica Chambers. She's 19 years old, graduated from high school, and she is staying at her mom's house. And she goes to a gas station nearby the home. And she tells her mother that she is leaving to go clean out her car and to go get something to eat. Within a few hours of that, you know, she is found in a situation that is horrible beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
And this story very quickly becomes national news. Jessica does not come home that night, and unfortunately, she will be dead by the next day.
And yes, all the cases that we cover are pretty brutal, but this one is especially brutal. So if you're sensitive to that stuff, we normally try to stay away from the gore and the graphic nature of all the crimes, going into details. But with the Jessica Chambers case, some of that we can't get around. So if you're sensitive to that, then you might want to not listen to this episode.
At 8:09 p.m., the fire department is going to respond to a vehicle on fire call. Now, fortunately, in this situation, they were able to arrive very quickly to this call because they were just on a recent call of a house on fire that they were leaving previously that put them in the area. When they arrive, they are greeted with a horrible sight. This is a young woman, and she's been very badly burned.
Well, I mean, I think you're skipping over it. I mean, let me handle this for a second. The firefighters show up at the scene. There's a car ablaze. Their first concern, obviously, is there anybody in the vehicle? And they don't assume so. This is a firefighter group. These are all volunteers. It's a very small town.
Mm-hmm.
But then out of the darkness comes this figure, and it's this young lady. 90% of her body is burnt. And I couldn't even imagine what that sight would be for them. And so now we have a whole different situation. We're not just putting out this fire. Now we got to take care of this. I mean, she's 90% burnt over her whole body. Pretty much the only thing that wasn't burnt was the soles of her feet.
Mm-hmm.
And now she is telling them or trying to communicate with them. And then they end up rushing her to the hospital.
Yeah, they life flight her out of there in a helicopter trying to save her life. And she's in extremely bad condition, bad shape. She does try to talk to one of the first responders. And it's later rumored that, excuse me, somebody at the scene had said that she had tried to tell them who had attacked her.
Right.
And that she may have said the word Derek or Eric.
Mm-hmm.
But this person was uncertain. Now, the police were very quick to come out and say that, you know, we cannot say with certainty that she said who attacked her. All we can say is that she did communicate with the first responders, and we are working on using that as a lead. So, unfortunately, when they arrive, when the first responders arrive, you know, as the captain said, they're responding to a car on fire. That's all they're expecting to see. You know, vehicles get in accidents, cars catch on fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a small town. We're talking like 400, maybe 500 people live in this area. And so they're not expecting to show up and see anything out of, you know, above and beyond a car on fire. And so when they see the young woman, when they see Jessica Chambers, she's described as stumbling blindly on the road. And she, again, as mentioned, she does go up to the first responders who are going to try to save her, and she's whispering or trying to communicate with them in some fashion, and she's saying what has been echoed as either Eric or Derek.
Right.
Again, this is not confirmed by either law enforcement or the district attorney.
They've been really good about keeping everything close to their vest in this case.
Now, one thing they would say after they rushed her out of there, they sent her to a hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, but she could not be saved. And they were reporting that she had received burns on 98% of her body, and that doctors could not even insert a breathing tube because her airway had been so badly damaged. Now, Jessica's mother, Lisa Chambers, states that Jessica went to go clean out her car, and then she was going to go get something to eat, and she never came home. Her father, Ben, would later tell the news and media a little more about how his daughter was found. You know, he says that the fire department arrived. Jessica was walking down the road and on fire. The only part of her body that wasn't burned was the bottom of her feet. And he would go on to say that they, whomever did this, they squirted lighter fluid down her throat and in her nose. And apparently she had been knocked out before this took place because she had a big gash on top of her head.
Yeah, so you have the gash on the head, and the interesting thing here is they constantly say lighter fluid. It's some kind of accelerant. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like it doesn't have to be the car was set on fire with gasoline and then that somebody used lighter fluid to pour down her throat, which is, you know, barbaric. Chances are, to me, whatever was used on the car was also used on her. Now, how did they get it down her esophagus? Because she was so badly burned inside, down her esophagus, and then up her like nasal passages.
Mm-hmm. And that's why the doctors are saying they could not use the breathing tube to try to help save her. Mm-hmm. But you know, this is why, unfortunately, because how she's found, this is why this case became such big news and such national news so quickly. We have a young woman who's burned alive, and she may have said who had attacked her to the first responders. You know, again, investigators would not comment on that to this day, but especially back then when this case was new in the late part of 2014. Now, one can only speculate. You know, I'm sure she probably tried to communicate something to the first responders. However, being that disoriented, she's probably in shock. She's got the gash to her head. She's so badly burnt, possibly even on, you know, her throat and face as well. I don't know how or what ability she would have to communicate anything.
Well, and again, all these reports coming out by her father, there is no autopsy report that I could find. So again, there's the trial happening, and so they don't release this information. At some point, the autopsy is going to be released, and would have more knowledge. But based on we can just go based off of what the father is saying.
Right, and that was his comments to the news and media in the early goings of this investigation. Now, Ben, the father, he works as a mechanic for the sheriff's department. Mm-hmm. So he may have been privy to some information, being that he's the father of the victim and that he works with some of the people investigating this case.
Well, and also his daughter was sent to a hospital. She passed away the next day. And then just the conversation that he's having with the doctors, it's not a full autopsy, but the doctors are obviously knowledgeable and the nurses are knowledgeable on what's happening with her and her condition to try to save her life.
Now, quickly in this investigation, there's another bit of information that comes out. So, of course, they're trying to piece together Jessica Chambers' last hours. You know, what did she do that last day and who may have been with her and could have had the means of attacking her that day? And it's quickly reported that there's a videotape that comes out. And this is surveillance footage from the gas station that we had mentioned that she had stopped off at. On the surveillance footage, you can see Jessica waving to someone out of the view of the camera, and then she goes over and talks to whom I presume is whomever she was waving to. Jessica eventually returns to her car. She finishes pumping gas, and she drives away. Now, during this brief stop at the gas station, you can also see a man in a striped shirt who appears to be filling up a gas can, and then he walks off. So of course police feel that this is a lead and that this is something that they need to find Jessica's killer.
So with the small town and this gas station being a hot spot and all these cameras that are set up at the gas station, this is going to be something that is going to give law enforcement a lot of clues and a lot of information to look into.
Yeah, and let's introduce the district attorney, John Champion, because if you start to look into this case, he's very prominent. He's at the forefront of almost every news clip that you're going to see out there, and he's given a lot of interviews since this attack. Now, as said...
Well, since this murder.
Yeah. John Champion is the district attorney for the area, and he goes on to clear up a few things and better describe some of the surveillance footage and the scene to which firefighters arrive. Champion does repeat that Jessica's mother had said that the 19-year-old had left the house to clean out her car and to get something to eat. There had been a rumor going around early in the investigation that Jessica was going to go to a party, but as anyone can see when you watch the surveillance footage, she is not dressed like she's going to go to a party. She has her hair just like she just put it up in a bun, and she's wearing what appears to be camouflage pajama pants. So she's very extremely casual, almost rolled out of bed casual. Plus, police would go on to speak with persons at the party that it was rumored that she was going to go to, and they all say that they had never seen Jessica at the party. This is all crucial stuff here because the authorities are trying to learn what happened to Jessica between the stop at the gas station and then about 90 minutes later when she's found in very bad shape and very badly burned. Champion also states that Jessica was not burning when she was found. This was just a rumor. She did go up to one of the firefighters and she did speak. Of course, Champion would not say what Jessica had said, but told the news that it certainly has given us a lead that we are following up on. He also states that the volunteer fire department that had responded to the car blaze was able to respond so fast because they were only a couple miles away at another call when the call came in. It was also clear early on that an accelerant, as the captain had said, was used, but they were not able to determine if the accelerant was poured on the car or onto Jessica or both. Now, Champion believes that the key to everything in this case is her cell phone.
Okay.
Jessica's phone. He was going under the assumption that she had received a call before she left her house. Now, Jessica's phone was found near her car. And so there's a bit of a process here, okay?
Well, let's start with the PJs, right? Right? So we got the... She's wearing PJs, so everybody's assuming... her plan that night, from all accounts, is that she was going to go to this party. Based on the footage, it doesn't seem like a lot of logical sense, but we're also coming from, we're old dudes, you know, like if we are going to a party, you know, it takes us a long time to get ready because we, you know, we look like dog shit, right? But this, and yeah, and women will take their time getting ready for events, but this is also not that uncommon for a girl to, oh, I got to run to the gas station first. I'm in my pajamas. She could have ran to the gas station and was expecting to come home, change, and then go to the party.
Right.
That's totally possible. Does that factor into what happened to her? Is that some kind of lead? I don't know. But that's a possibility is what I'm saying.
Well, it's only a lead because, one, if she actually went to the party, which I think they're able to determine that she did not
go to the party.
Now, from there, your next lead is going to be, okay, well, who would she have attended this party with had she ended up there?
Right. And then did they go to the party?
Right, right.
Was there somebody else missing from the party?
Yeah, because now you have to piece together who was with her at that moment. You know, we have that 90 minutes from the time that she leaves the gas station to the time that she's found. We need to figure out what happened during those 90 minutes. Now, this is why the cell phone becomes so important because, you know, with the way everybody, you know, with the way everybody texts and calls so much these days, there might be a text, there could be a phone call that took place that would lead them to figure out how she ended up in that wooded area with her car on fire.
Well, what's, you know, what happens as far as, for me, as far as fascinations with the case, is you have a time frame, right? You have a window, right? So you have a window, and in this case, she's at the gas station, and then she's found. It's a 90-minute window. Mm-hmm. And it's piecing together that now, today, with social media, Snapchat, all that stuff, these windows of these cases are going to become smaller and smaller. Because we're going to have, you know, because we, how many cases have we covered where we're like, well, nobody really talked to her for days and days, and then she was murdered. So now you have days and days of a window, mm-hmm. right? But now with social media and technology, these windows are going to be very small. We're going to know what happened 15 minutes before or 5 minutes before. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're going on. So what I'm also, there's a call that sends her, does the call send her to the gas station? Jessica gets a call. Mm-hmm. Does that call send her to the gas station? Or was it just a random call?
Well, do you want to get into the gas station? I think we need to. I think we got to talk about the gas station now. So what did she do while she was at the gas station that we know about? She arrived. She was pumping gas. She waved to somebody, went and spoke to somebody. Mm-hmm. She does go into the gas station. And apparently she is friendly with the store attendant mm-hmm. and would speak with him when she would go in there. He said something to media later that she had purchased $14 worth of gas, which was more than usual for her. She was, you know how some people go in, you see them at the gas station, they go, give me five on pump two. Well, right. She was that kind of person. She took a few bucks and filled up the car. You know, but on this occasion...
It might just be because she didn't have money to fill up the tank.
He just thought that it was a little abnormal because that's the first thing that the detectives are going to ask him. Did she do anything or say anything abnormal that night? Well, right. She purchased $14 worth of gas, which is considerably more than she usually buys. Mm-hmm. He says that he had commented to her about the amount of gasoline purchased, and she said that she had somewhere to go, but did not elaborate on that. Now, in the video footage, as the captain had said, there's a lot of cameras going on here. So you see different camera views, camera one, camera two, and so on and so forth. But piecing all these together, you can see her movements, her going over and saying hi to somebody. She goes into the gas station. There are several.
It looks like she puts out a cigarette before she goes in.
Yeah, there are several men inside this gas station. There's mm-hmm. about three of them.
Just hanging out.
They're just hanging out. Like the captain said, this is kind of the spot, you know, the hot spot mm-hmm. in town where people would go and they would just chat. But there's three men kind of hanging out off to her side while she's up paying for presumably the gas that she purchased.
Well, I'm from a small town, and for some reason we had a car wash that people would hang out at. There's a bowling alley and a car wash, mm-hmm. and people would just drive their cars over to the car wash and hang out. Never made any sense to me. Anyways, so yeah, people are just hanging out. Now, it looks to me as she goes to an ATM machine in the footage.
Yeah, I don't know if she went to an ATM, but there are two transactions that take place with the teller, with the attendant. She goes in and presumably pays for the gas, and then it's believed that she went back and purchased a pack of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're back to this magical hour or this 90 minutes of where was Jessica and how did she end up at this wooded area? Now, the thing that's troubling here is, you know, the captain asked why was she at the gas station? It may just have been to pick up cigarettes and gas up the car. We don't know what activity was going on with that cell phone.
One could assume... Like, that's what I'm saying. We're trying to close out this window. And so it's like, but one could assume if she's going to, you know, in her PJs to get gas, why you're getting gas at night for a reason. Mm-hmm. Is it for the next day? Is it to go to this party? Are you getting cigarettes just because you're a smoker? Or are you getting extra cigarettes because you're going to a party? See what I'm saying? I'm trying to figure out what her intention is
right.
for later on in the night.
Right. I think that, you know, investigators are working off of the assumption that they're taking her at her word, that she was just simply going to clean out her car and get something to eat. She's dressed to me as though she's returning to her mom's house afterwards. But yeah, you're right. What were her intentions after that? We don't know.
I think you're totally correct. Her intention is to go back to her mom's house. But what is her intention after that? I mean, it's at night. Why are you cleaning up your car? Are you cleaning up your car because you want to pick up a guy? I mean, think about, you know, I kind of have a messy car here and there. But if I was going to pick up a girl for a date, I want to clean it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be Captain Slob, right? You don't want them to get in the car and go, ugh, like there's all these, you know, wrappers everywhere. So maybe, but that's what I'm saying. Was that her intent? And then, did she meet up with this person earlier? You know, did she not go back to her mom's house? You know?
Right, right. Well, but the thing here is, right, you've got to figure out if she met with the person that set the fire,
right?
Or was she carjacked, or did something you know, get in the way of her plans that evening?
Right.
You know, was there a text or a phone call that led her elsewhere?
Right. And that's another difficult thing about this case. I mean, it's a fascinating case, but because of the trial and because of this, you know, it's not case closed, that this information is not out there. Normally we cover a case and we can say, okay, based off the trial and based of what the cops released, we know their phone records. This, we're kind of in the dark.
Yeah, there's been very little released on this case. And due to that, we've seen nothing but rumor. And unfortunately, you know, this case was very hard to read about and research for the obvious that she was the horrible manner that she was killed.
Right.
But on top of that, there are so many news articles and there's so many news clips that you will read something in one article and then read another article that will tell you that first one was all rumor. You know, and so there's a lot of this back and forth when you look into this case. Just a prime example. The father says that she was found burning when the first responders arrive. And the district attorney quickly says, well, that's not true. That was just a rumor that was going on in the area at the time. So with these rumors, you're going to see this time and time again in this case. I mean, very quickly into this investigation, by January of 2015, there are some wild theories out there. And they're just about everything that one can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Mentions of the KKK, of bikers, Aryan Brotherhood, meth gangs, everything that you can think of.
Right.
There were theories for these for this case.
Yeah, and we can dive into that right after a quick beer break. All right, we're back. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. So we're knee deep in this case, right, Captain? We have this young woman who was found and she's been murdered. And we're trying to piece together her last hours before the attack and before she's killed. Now, as we said, there's rumors, there's theories coming out. Why? Because the detectives, they're holding everything close to the vest here. They're not releasing a whole lot of information. And this will cause the rumor mill to run wild, right?
And with Jessica being so brutally, you know, the murder was so brutal. I mean, somebody set her on fire, set her car on fire. Fire as well. Everybody wants to know answers. Everybody wants to know why, and they also want somebody to pay for this. Somebody, they want justice to be served. So a close friend of Jessica, a man claiming to be close friends of Jessica, claimed also that Jessica at some point lived with his mother for about 6 months or so. Comes out saying, well, look, this is pretty simple. This all goes back to her father, Ben. So he claims that Jessica Chambers' father, Ben, was a meth dealer. Now, like we talked before, Jessica's father works for the police department.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy's claim is that on the side that he's also a meth dealer. And this, her death, is a direct cause of him being a drug dealer. And so what he comes out, and then the other interesting thing here is that her brother Ben, not her father, but her brother Ben, a year or so prior to all this, was in a single car accident, and he was, he died. So he also claims that that was related to the father being a drug dealer.
Like, that there's some kind of turf war going on.
Right. There's
amongst drug dealers, and that they're attacking Ben's family.
Right. Basically, like, hey, if we killed off your son, you know, so knock it off, and just and in the hopes that he's going to stop selling meth. And then again, when that didn't happen, now, well, we're going to kill your daughter. He also makes claims that Jessica had some run-ins with these gangs before because of her father as well. They're targeting this girl, and she was gang raped twice.
That was one of the hardest parts about this case for me, Captain, when I was looking into it. There were so many rumors going on, but on top of that, for every news story that you would read, you know, you have the blog commenters below that you can read their comments. And a lot of them were so racist on both sides of the tracks, I guess you mm-hmm. could say, you know, whether it being African-American people saying racist things because she was a white victim, or white people saying racist things about African-American people being, you know, that she was, you know, known to have dated African-American men, and mm-hmm. that this case is probably that she pissed off some white boy that was infatuated with her.
Right. The motives being race related.
Yeah. And that's what was so disconcerting for me when I was researching this case, was that every news article that I read, there was some form of racism by the readers, you mm-hmm. know, and at some point, you got to be looking for justice and not just pointing the finger at maybe some people you don't like for unknown reasons. We're talking about a small town here.
It seemed to me that a lot of people had, you know, previous agendas.
Yes.
And then then they're looking at this case and whatever their agenda is, you know, so if it's like, oh, well, I don't believe that white women should date black men. So then I see this case and I go, oh, see, this is what happens.
Right.
And it's like, I mean, maybe there is motive for that. I mean, we talked roughly like it's possible that some of the guys that she dated were in gangs. It seems like this area, you know, has a lot of gang activity.
Yeah.
And if she was dating a guy in one gang, then maybe that's her murder was retaliation on that gang. Mm-hmm. And that's very possible.
Yeah. But the thing is here with, as you said, most people, some of these people will go into it looking at it one way and they skew the events to follow their theory.
Right.
The problem here is whomever did this, they had to treat somebody this way and to kill them in this manner. This, to me, there's something more involved, that you're either dealing with an absolute loose cannon or you're dealing with somebody that's got a lot of hatred and that is probably likely to kill other people. This is not just something that you do as a retaliation, in my opinion. Not something you do because of an infatuation. It's a senseless crime, though. So trying to make sense out of a senseless crime, puts us in a bad spot.
Right. I don't agree on that level because I think, you know, it's kind of this alpha thing, you know, who's the alpha dog in these gangs? And so it's always taking things to the next level. So yeah, if it was gang related, if it was drug related on her brother's death, oh, we ran this guy off the road, he died in a car accident. Then they're upping the ante and saying, okay, well, we can't just shoot somebody, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to make a statement here. So that's where look, would this person kill again? Yeah, whoever did this is an absolute psychopath, is an absolute fucking monster, is an absolute fucking animal, and you know, it's ridiculous. But they will kill again. But to say that, well, I don't believe somebody would do this heinous of a crime, just if it was gang related. I don't buy that. I think it's very possible.
So let's get back into some of the facts of this case, right? So we have at roughly 5:30, Jessica Chambers is seen on the surveillance camera. This is at the gas station that we had discussed. Now, we did say that they found, they were able to retrieve her cell phone near her vehicle at the scene of the crime. Now, they are able to determine later that there was phone activity at the crime scene where she would later be found. And this phone activity took place at approximately 7:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. Now, at 8:09 p.m. is when the report of a car on fire goes out and they get the call. Now, at 8:13, remember we had said they showed up very quickly. Just 4 minutes later, they find the vehicle and then they find Jessica Chambers. Mm-hmm. At 9:30 p.m., you know, Jessica has already been life flighted to Memphis to try to save her. But at 9:30 p.m., we still have a crime scene that we're dealing with. Now, there is a tow truck driver who shows up and he removes the vehicle. And he's going to take it to back to the police impound lot where they're going to, you know, test it for whatever that they need to test it for. Hopefully they did some proper testing at the crime scene itself. Mm-hmm. But he is going to stop off along the way, which I think is probably extremely frowned upon. But he stops off at this very same gas station that Jessica was seen earlier on the surveillance footage.
Right.
Now, what happens here is he's stopping off to buy a pack of cigarettes. Well, the store attendant then proceeds to take pictures of the burnt vehicle. And he would later post those onto Facebook, and he would also state some details about the crime. Now, later we would learn that a lot of these details that he states on there is simply more rumor than actual fact.
Mm-hmm.
But what he does here is he throws himself into the suspect ring.
Well, and the, like we said before, this gas station is kind of a social gathering. So how many, this rumor mill in this small town, and who's seeing it or who's hearing it? It would be, the, you know, like the bartenders or in this case, the gas station attendant. And now for some reason he's posting this stuff on Facebook.
Yeah. And what this whole thing is going to come down to is going to be that hour, that last hour that she was alive and her cell phone and the cell phone activity. This is what they need to figure out. And that's the process though. There's a process of figuring out that cell phone. One, you have to get the rights to look up all the records of the usage of the cell phone. And once you've cleared that hurdle, you may have to figure out the password or figure out how to access the cell phone to view the activity.
Yeah. And you'll see this time and time again as they're interviewing people from the town saying, oh yeah, we were contacted by the police because Jessica at some point, you know, contacted me a couple days before or the day of. And then the police are starting to question these individuals.
Now, I don't know what the father does. You know, I don't know him from anybody. But I never really liked the father theory, whether mm-hmm. it be... I believe that person that had mentioned that this was in retaliation to something he was doing or some kind of turf war,
right.
That man had also stated that he believed that Ben was a suspect and being questioned by police. I don't know if that's the facts. What I do know is mm-hmm. that the sheriff's department, the police department, the district attorney's office, they interviewed close to 200 people regarding this case. And this was late in 2015. So we're only less than a year after this whole investigation has started. And they've interviewed over 200 people. We're talking about a town of only 400 to 500 people. You've almost interviewed half of the occupants of this town trying to figure out what had happened. Now, of those 200 people that were interviewed during the course of this, they figure out a few things, okay? And a lot of this is going to revolve around persons at the gas station that we had spoke of earlier. Now, first, we have that the gas station attendant who became a suspect because he took the photos. And what ends up happening with his story is he ends up basically being run out of town. Because once he becomes a suspect, he starts receiving death threats and all kinds of threats. And so he hightails it out of town. Now, the police would go on further to state that they do not see him as a suspect, that they've interviewed this man and they don't have him on their list.
Right. But we see this all the time where you're guilty in the public eye.
Mm-hmm. And now another person that was of interest, as we had said, was the man in the striped shirt that was seen on the surveillance footage. pumping gas, what looks like he's filling up a gas tank or a gas can, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Now, he was interviewed as well as the three men that were inside the gas station at the time. And they, the police, it's funny here because if you read certain newspaper articles, they do say that none of these people are, they or that they have been cleared, all right, that they've all been cleared in the investigation. I've never seen those words or heard those words coming out of the district attorney's mouth. Because what he simply says is that those people have been interviewed, they've been talked to, and right. they are not suspects in this case. He's not saying that they're cleared, but they're not suspects. Now, what does take place in this investigation, throughout the investigation, there are rumors all along, like the captain had said, that this could be some form of gang activity or some kind of gang-related crime. What that leads to, and the district attorney's words are, that he does not believe that this is a gang-related crime. However, it does lead them to several gang members or people involved in gang-related type activities.
Right, but my argument would be if she was murdered by a gang member, then therefore it's gang-related.
Yeah, what they end up doing is they will arrest and speak with 17 suspected area gang members. This took place in December of 2015. They're arrested on gun, drugs, and counterfeit charges, amongst other charges. But again, the district attorney, John Champion, he does not think that any of these suspects, of these 17, are related to Jessica Chambers' murder. But he did say that while the investigation led them to them being investigated for other crimes, he did state that in their plea negotiations, all will be given an opportunity to help themselves, and maybe that will bring us closer to the truth.
Right, closure. So almost over a year goes by, and the rumor mill is going crazy because the police are keeping everything close to the vest, but now we have a suspect. Now we have an individual that we're going to charge in the murder of Jessica Chambers.
Yeah, there's a man, Quentin Tellis. He's 27 years old. And the district attorney would say that he was a suspect early on in the case. However, they let the investigation lead them elsewhere. And he did not become the focal point of their investigation until the fall of 2015. Now, Tellis, he had once lived in Cortland, and that is where the district attorney says that he and Jessica Chambers had become friends. There's the district attorney does not elaborate on the relationship that they had, but he states that Tellis moved from Mississippi to Louisiana in the summer of 2015. This is the summer after Jessica Chambers is killed.
Right.
Now, while he's there, Quentin Tellis is arrested in August of 2015 on three counts of unauthorized use of a credit card. A debit card. And this debit card would be in connection to another homicide victim.
Right.
This is a woman that's identified as a 34-year-old University of Louisiana Monroe student from Taiwan. According to an affidavit in the case, Tellis used her bank card belonging to this missing woman on April 7th. Mm-hmm. This was the day before her body was found. And again, he used that same card on August 18th and August 19th, each time he's withdrawing $500. The authorities had also procured photo evidence, and they interviewed Quentin Tellis on August 20th, at which point he admitted that he used the Chase bank card on the three listed transactions that I had just stated. And he also admitted that he was the individual seen in the ATM photos that the police were questioning him about. Following the questioning of Quentin Tellis and him admitting that he used the bank card and that he was the person seen in the ATM photos, the police, they get a warrant to enter Mr. Tellis's home. Mm-hmm. Now, this is his home in Monroe. And they discover there a quarter pound of marijuana in his bedroom that is packaged for sale. So the suspect, he had stated that, I sell marijuana. And so he's arrested and booked on several charges, that being using the dead woman's debit card, as well as being charged with possession of marijuana with intent to sell. So when Quentin Tellis comes back onto the radar, right, when he becomes the focal point of their investigation into the Jessica Chambers murder, Quentin Tellis is already being held in a correctional facility in Monroe, Louisiana. This is about a four-hour drive from
Portland,
Mississippi.
I just wanted to make it clear. Like, he was a suspect. There's somebody that was on the radar with Jessica Chambers at the beginning. Then he moves after her death, which is a little sketchy anyways. Then he's involved with this debit card. And now they're going, okay, maybe we need to look at this guy again.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And
I just wanted it to be very clear.
Well, and but the thing that is unclear here is while they transport him from Louisiana to Mississippi, they then charge him with the death and murder of Jessica Chambers.
Yeah. So what did they know?
We don't know.
Right. That's what's so frustrating about this damn case.
We don't know what they know because they won't say anything. Now, what they will say is that if you listen to and read the district attorney and what he said about this case all along, he's always said that this case will go back to the cell phone, that her cell phone is going to present us with a lead that's going to lead us to an arrest and then an indictment and hopefully a conviction. So in this case, while they won't state the specifics of that, we know that they've arrested this man after they were able to access her phone and to see the activity of her phone. Now, this guy, they bring him in, and it's unclear to me what the motive is, what his motive is for murder. Now, they have gone on to say some things like, you know, the forensic evidence in this will be a big part and a driving force in the prosecution of Quentin Tellis. Now, did they find something at the scene? I don't know. Did they find something in his home in Louisiana? We don't know that. However, there's been something to connect him to this case, and it's not just that he had some kind of friendship or relationship with Jessica Chambers.
Right, right. Yeah, because we could just assume we're bringing this guy back. Now let's start questioning him. They don't do that. They charge him. Mm-hmm. So there's a smoking gun somewhere.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to see is now he's going to stand trial for the murder of Jessica Chambers in 2017. So next year, I believe it's in June or July, this trial will start. And that's when we're going to see how that they connected him to this crime. You know, they did figure out one thing forensically regarding this case, that they believed all along that the person that set fire to the car and set fire to Jessica was most likely in the car before this took place. I don't know what information or evidence they could retrieve seeing the state of the vehicle. I mean, the car was burnt so badly. It was a black car. And when you see pictures of it now, it's white. Right. It's a completely white car. But they believed all along that this was a very up close and personal attack and murder that took place, that this person attacked her physically and was in the vehicle when this happened.
So then he stands trial for this case.
Correct. He's been charged and he's been indicted, and they will go to trial in the summer of next year. Now, this is a capital murder case.
Right.
So there is the opportunity for the death penalty in this case. Now, but we all know that usually they're going to kind of weigh their options here. The district attorney has not outright said that they're going to seek the death penalty. Now, obviously, the community really wants that to happen. And I'm sure a lot of people listening want this to happen because of how horrifying her death was.
Well, yeah. And if he's charged, maybe they should throw some lighter fluid down his fucking throat and set this motherfucker on fire.
Well, but the thing is here, they have to weigh their evidence, because when you're going to seek the death penalty, it usually needs to be a very open and closed case.
Right.
You know, it needs to be very obvious to the jury that this guy deserves the death penalty. And again, because they've not released anything, we don't know what kind of evidence they have on this guy. Now, we should point out, though, that he's also been indicted and he's been charged with the murder of the student,
right,
of the debit card that he was using.
Yeah, because at the time, they didn't have enough evidence, so therefore, they discharged him with the use of the card. That gets him in their custody. That gets them access to this information. So, you know, if you watch the Nancy Grace clips, you know, and she's going, and this guy got away 10 years for murder. I don't know if that's how she sounds, but anyways, guys, she's annoying sometimes. But anyways, that was like, wow, this guy's going to get away with murder. Boom. Now he's connected with Jessica Chambers. Hopefully he gets sentenced to death for that. Like I said, I mean, this, I think it's just because, you know, again, she's 19, whole life ahead of her, all that stuff, right? But this is just so brutal. I mean, if that's true, I mean, setting somebody on fire, that's like a nightmare, right?
Yeah, that's everybody's nightmare.
Like, I mean, it sounds bad because we talk about cases every week, but there are some events to me that seem like they trump other, you know, as far as the brutality of it.
Well, and, you're exactly right. I mean, this case, and we talked about this earlier, that how hard it was to research this case, and half of that was because of the brutality of the violence in this case. And then on top of that, it was a physically draining case to read about because of the violence. I mean, you know, you say sometimes there's ones that aren't as hard to research. You know, last week we talked about Beverly Potts. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a horrible crime and a horrible case as well. But something that took place 60 years ago, you feel a little more distanced from that type of crime. And it almost feels like you're reading about a story rather than this seems very...
Yeah, more of a history lesson, which this seems very relevant. It's very new. And then also you just... you know, just think about when you're 19 and you're driving around and, you know, again, 19-year-old, when we talked about, well, she never really filled up the tank. Well, it's something you do when you're 19, throw in a couple bucks because that's what you have. And you start just really identifying with this individual. And then if you lived in a small town or had friends, you know, grow up in a small town. And so, I mean, I'm not normally one to just say, let's kill this dude, you know, but for some reason, this case, like, this is horror. It's sad. And then I see pictures of this guy, and he's the definition of a monster. He's the definition of the devil, which then also started rumors that this was a satanic act and all this other junk.
But you're going to continue to see rumors about this case and wild theories about this case, even though they have their so-called man. You know,
well,
you're going to continue to see that until the trial comes out and we start to see what links him to the crime and who he is exactly. Now, I don't want to prosecute the guy here in the garage because we should assume that he's innocent. You know, but the thing is
I could do that if I wasn't drinking
with the death of the student from Louisiana Monroe University. That was an extremely violent death as well. I believe she was stabbed over 30 times.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I think this guy is just a freaking monster.
And what we're talking about here, though, is somebody that has the ability, that is capable of very heinous and violent, violent murders that are up close and personal.
Right.
I can see why these two are very linked, you know, that you can link these two together because of the amount of violence, because of how close you would have had to been when you were attempting to end that person's life. Whomever did this to Jessica, basically, they set her and her vehicle on fire and they walked away. They walked away hoping that she would never walk away and that she would never be able to tell what had happened to her. Now, she survived long enough, and we don't know what tips she gave or
what. And again, that will probably come out in the trial.
Right. We don't know what she said to the first responders, but I hope she had the last word in this case.
So the stage is set. The trial is set for the summer of 2017. So this is a case that we will jump back into once we hear news, and I'm sure people like Nancy Grace and stuff will jump all over this trial.
Yeah, and you know what, though? Maybe for a form of punishment for, you know, whether you receive life or death or whatever, maybe you should have to spend like an afternoon with Nancy Grace if you're a guilty, horrible person and just let her yell at you for an afternoon. Now, but
mean, because I do sometimes watch her show and enjoy it, so I don't want to bash her too much. I mean, she's
Well, anyway, but the thing is that we are will find out about is there's going to be a couple things happen with this case even before the trial takes place, right? We're going to have to figure out, is this going to be a death penalty case? They'll have to figure that out, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that before the summer of 2017. But the other issue is here, when would he stand trial for the murder of the university student? Mm-hmm. And will that be a death penalty case as well? Because both of those states carry the death penalty, and these are both horrible crimes.
And of course, this case has to come out the week of Christmas, and I think I dropped the most F-bombs I have on the episode.
You're going to have to clean it up a little bit, mister.
Yeah, I apologize if that offends. I mean, we set the bar at, you know, this is, we put the E, little E on there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I try not to drop them too, but this is just, sometimes you read about this stuff and it just hits you in a weird way. And it just lingers with you. And then for 3 or 4 days, you're just freaking depressed about everything. And you just you lost hope in humanity anyways. So we'll give updates on this case once we know something. And we got any recommended reading for the week?
We do. This week we are recommending Psychopaths in Our Lives by Diane Emerson. As you probably know, most of what is written about psychopaths are from the perspective of violent psychopaths. But in some cases, serial killers are operating on a much lower level than psychopaths that are successful in masking their true character. This is not one of those all of these people are bad kind of stories.
Right.
The author wants people to see the truth about what psychopaths are doing and for people to recognize how they operate. Again, that's Psychopaths in Our Lives by Diane Emerson, and you can pick that up by going to truecrimegarage.com and click on the recommended page. And thank you, everybody out there, for listening.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to take this moment to say happy holidays, Merry Christmas, happy Kwanzaa. I'm sure I'm going to...
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. I'll light menorahs for everybody.
Whatever you're celebrating, do it with your friends and family, and let's all be great to each other this holiday season and all of next year.
I have a couple drinks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Break bread. Yep, we'll be here next week in the garage, and we will see you next week in the garage. Until then, have a very Merry Christmas and happy holidays. And until next week, be good, be kind, and don't live.